From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mitch Biter, assistant producer in VOA's Current Affairs Unit. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Emerson T. Brooking, co-author of the timely book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media, which tackles the questions that arise when war goes online and the online world goes to war. The book, which Emerson co-wrote with fellow defense expert Peter Singer, explores the collision of war, politics, and social media. Social media can be weaponized and is now being manipulated to sway political opinions, fuel popular uprisings, and even affect the course of military and political campaigns. Mobilizing, coordinating, corrupting, spreading influence, people are using social media as 21st century battlegrounds. The Washington Post describes the book as, quote, not a warning about tomorrow's war, but a map for those who don't understand how the battlefield has already changed, unquote. And U.S. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia called it a, quote, wake-up call to the wider challenges facing us, unquote. Like War addresses how Russia, the so-called Islamic State, and U.S. President Donald Trump have all mastered the internet as a weapon. It also asks important questions such as, does social media expose the truth or bury it? What role do ordinary citizens and social media companies such as Facebook and Twitter play in spreading disinformation and fueling extremist content, which leads to real-world violence? Author Emerson Brooking is a defense analyst and resident fellow at the Digital Forensic Research Lab of the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank here in Washington. Prior to his post, Emerson was a research fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the youngest researcher in a generation to receive such an appointment. He has served as an advisor on information warfare to the U.S. National Security Council, U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the U.S. intelligence community. On this edition of the program, we'll be talking with Emerson Brooking about his new book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media, as well as the new paradigm the book outlines for understanding and defending against unprecedented threats of our networked world. Emerson Brooking joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome Mitch Biter, our assistant producer in the Current Affairs Unit. We produce Press Conference USA, Encounter, and Issues in the News.
Thanks for having me on, Carol.
Well, Emerson, first of all, congratulations to you and Peter Singer on this critical book.
Thank you.
Please explain the title, Like War, which is spelled as one word, and how was it written? Talk about the process and the underlying premise of the book.
So the title, Like War, has a double meaning. First, we're describing something that is like a traditional conflict. It often sits adjacent to traditional conflicts. But like war is also fought through Facebook likes or through the other things, the page views, the emojis, the clicks, which people garnish on particular bits of content. It's a battle of psychological and algorithmic manipulation, which is playing out over social media, fought between an indeterminate number of actors, thousands of these conflicts playing out each day. And as to how we wrote the book, my co-author Peter and I were tracking this issue back in 2012 and 2013, the idea that military conflicts would begin to be influenced by online conversation. So the impetus for our project was the Westgate Molotech in Nairobi, Kenya. This came in mid-2013. It was conducted by Al-Shabaab, which was a terrorist group, one of the first and most proficient to use Twitter. And over the course of 3 days, some 67 people were killed in a siege of that mall, in an occupation. But what made it unique was that even as the terrorists occupied the building, hunting down the people inside, Shabaab was live tweeting about it. They were giving running updates. They were sending photographs from within the building. And they essentially controlled the narrative, because as they were doing this, Kenyan security forces, acting in a more traditional manner, were very mute about the updates that they were giving to the press. But because the information environment had changed so fundamentally, and because the international media was hungry for updates, they were essentially running whatever information Shabaab gave them. And as you think about the nature of terrorism, which is really the nature of spectacle, of grabbing headlines and striking terror in the hearts of observers, This was exactly what Shabab wanted, and this was a powerful early demonstration of how social media would change terrorism and conflict dynamics. But as we wrote the book, we watched this field evolve very rapidly. In 2014, the world came to know the Islamic State, also known as ISIS, as they invaded northern Iraq, as they launched a hashtag campaign to coincide with their assault on the city of Mosul. Then we watched this field evolve again. We watched as, in 2016, the Trump campaign and other political campaigns pioneered new techniques by which, lacking a lot of conventional resources and advantages, they nonetheless were able to win national elections by harnessing a similarly savvy sense of the information environment. Shortly after that, it comes out that we also had foreign actors influencing both our U.S. election, but also the referendum in Britain, the Brexit vote, and numerous other national elections. And then one more thing happened as we were concluding our work, which was in mid-2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia. There was a rally of white supremacists in which one counter-protester was killed. But what made this unique was that these were adherents of a political movement that many people had thought eradicated. Many people thought it had lost all support. But thanks to the internet, thanks to the new ways that people could find each other of a similar ideological bent and organize, we saw this virulent movement essentially returning, and we saw an echo of many of the dynamics that we'd begun tracking 5 years prior.
Well, that's a fascinating narrative, Emerson, and I just have a quick follow-up. How did these social media platforms, particularly Facebook, go from helping spawn democracy movements, positive movements like the Arab Spring, turn into these weapons that foment lies, hatred, and violence that used by al-Shabaab, by the so-called Islamic State, by white supremacists, etc.?
So there are two things to consider here. First is the rhetoric of the social media companies themselves. There was a gospel all through late 90s and mid-2000s that the growth of the internet was an unfettered good. It would be good for democracy, it would invariably empower pro-democracy activists, and that essentially it would be a positive force for freedoms around the world. And to an extent, this was true, but this also fed very much into the incentives of these companies, which is to grow as big as possible. And this was essentially unquestioned in Washington and elsewhere, because we hadn't seen any negative side effects of it. The high point of this gospel of the internet, this cyber utopianism, came in 2011 during the Arab Spring, in which we watched pro-democracy protesters in Tunisia, in Egypt, and elsewhere around the world overthrow authoritarian regimes, thanks in large part to their organization via platforms like Facebook and Twitter. But, as we know now, this was a high watermark. In the years since, what we've seen is that many authoritarian regimes or bad actors or terrorist groups, having observed the effectiveness of these platforms for democratic mobilization, have gravitated to them as well to pursue their own agendas. And what we know now is that these early pro-democracy groups had no monopoly on these platforms. They simply arrived there first. Now we've seen these other groups play catch-up. And all the goods and evils that inhabit any new technology have now come to social media.
Let me turn to my colleague Mitch for a question.
Emerson, thanks for coming on. You touched on it before. I just wanted to ask, how did your work for the U.S. intelligence community influence your perspective in writing this book, notably for the NSC and the Joint Chiefs of Staff? I'd imagine you have a pretty unique take.
Mitch, that's a great question. My work in advising and observation of the U.S. government has taught me how difficult it is for the West and for established governments to adapt to many of the new paradigms we see in place now. To give you one sense, if you think about the development of the U.S. military, ever since the Second World War, U.S. military operations have been premised on an absolute control of the environment, whether it's land, sea, or air. We've always had this conventional superiority in any conflict in which we fight, and our adversaries have always been very much on the back end, looking for new asymmetric ways to oppose us. But what's so remarkable about the rise of social media and its use in warfare is that it enables very weak groups to invest heavily in the manipulation of information. And by doing so, They can shift perceptions. They can shift an understanding of the facts on the ground. And they can gain an extraordinary advantage with a relatively tiny investiture of resources. I'll give you one specific example. As I know listeners here will know, Russian influence in the 2016 U.S. election has been an obsession of discussion here in Washington and I think around the world. The actual Russian operation took perhaps 100 people and a budget of $10 million. The vast majority of people involved were not hard-boiled intelligence agents. They were millennials who just couldn't get jobs and were working for essentially a copy of a Western marketing firm, only they were instead spreading state propaganda and misinformation. That's not an investment of too much money to have an extraordinary outsized effect on the international system. Think of the example of Russia. Think of the example of ISIS and its theatrical terrorism. You don't have to spend that much resource to gain an extraordinary advantage in the system. And this is something that the U.S. is still working very hard to come to grips with. But because we've been the dominant actor in so many other spaces, we are on the back foot.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Emerson T. Brooking. He's the co-author of the book Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mitch Beiter, assistant producer in our Current Affairs Programming Unit. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also download the podcast using iTunes. And please follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Collins Dirichukwu Enugu from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to Emerson Brooking, author of Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. Emerson, let's talk about the role of social media platforms in the promotion of this negative content. Why have social media platforms allowed what some have characterized as toxic digital waste to overwhelm their platforms? Some analysts say that their very platforms are designed to perpetuate sensational posts, fake posts, and personas because they generate the most clicks and likes, which basically helps their profit.
So there are two things to consider here. First is that, as I mentioned earlier, this gospel of growth in Silicon Valley, this idea that the internet was an unfettered good, the people who run these platforms, who invented them, and who've grown them to these unprecedented sizes, most of them are, by training, engineers who are interested in growth and in making cool new technological products to be enjoyed by people. As a result, they've been very hesitant to confront the growing political power that they wield, even though you might have foreseen it. If Facebook's goal was to connect the world, and they largely have with a population of 2.3 billion people on that platform, but if that was their goal, then it stands to reason that as they made decisions about what sort of information would be allowed on that platform, that they would have a greater and greater political influence. Anyway, only in baby steps have these companies begun to accept that they have this power. And in some cases, they've gone to great strides to avoid that responsibility. But that's the first piece. That's one reason we see even today, you know, so much toxic material, videos of terrorist attacks, hate speech, and extremism proliferating across these platforms. But the other thing that you hit on is that this problem is due to basic human nature. These platforms are designed in a very democratic way. Content and information that garners some attention begins to rise to the top of the news feeds of other people. And over time, that content goes viral. But what goes viral is the sort of stuff that people are choosing to pay attention to from the offset. And the fact is that we are drawn to exciting, salacious material. We are drawn, especially, above all else, to things that give us outrage, that make us angry. We now have a large enough body of studies regarding psychology of internet users to understand that anger is the single greatest motivator when you decide to share something. As a result, because the content shared on these platforms does not have to have any connection to the truth. There's no fact-checking. There are no editors before it goes out there. As a result of all this, we see a viral spread of misinformation that's often premised on making people as angry as possible. And one of the most surefire ways to do that is to demonize ethnic and religious minorities.
Mitch.
Going on to the other, I guess, side of that spectrum, how effective do you think government censorship is on political thought? A notable example is China's censorship and recently Sri Lanka's censorship of social media after the recent attacks. Do you think social media is better at exposing truth or hiding truth?
I'd like to draw a distinction here. I hate to say it, but I think social media is better at hiding the truth. Today, there are roughly 20 billion devices that are connected to the internet. I've spoken to people who run clandestine operations in the U.S. military, and the lesson again and again is that secrets now come with a half-life, that nothing remains secret for long, that some digital evidence of virtually anything will be put out into the open. However, it's also true that it's never been so easy to sow lies and to plant false information into this information environment. As a result, the new form of censorship is quite often denying clear evidence that something happened, sowing a dozen counter-narratives, even if they are contradictory to each other, and then sitting back and saying, well, we'll never know what happened because there are so many different explanations out there. In a nutshell, that's how disinformation and censorship by disinformation functions. But I want to draw a distinction between that and what we see in Sri Lanka and increasingly in places around the world, which is governments responding by shutting down access to the internet, even ostensibly democratic governments shutting down access to the internet. And it's increasingly my sense, tracking these issues, that many of the greatest harms that we associate with the internet today will continue to happen even if access is shut down for the vast majority of people. Virtually any government shutdown of this system can be circumvented by people if they are savvy enough. As a consequence, say you will never stop a terrorist or a bad actor from using the internet to coordinate. The main thing you accomplish, if you as a democratic or ostensibly democratic government shut down the internet, the main thing you accomplish is making it much harder for everyday people to receive information, even to feel a sense of safety if they have some connection to the outside world. So I would say the truth is becoming ever harder to find. But if you are a democratic government, you should not turn to wholesale shutting down the internet, because it often harms those people who you're most inclined to protect.
Emerson, I want to pick up on the contrast between authoritarian regimes and democracies. Obviously, it's much easier for authoritarian regimes to manipulate social media. We saw that in the 2016 campaign with Russia influencing our elections with the use of bots, the Internet Research Agency, ordinary people posing as Americans, disseminating false information. But it's harder, isn't it, for democracies to get a handle on these bad actors. So we have an uneven playing field. That must be why our own national security apparatus has a difficult time in combating the nefarious impact of social media.
For democratic governments, mis- and disinformation presents a profound challenge. Because what distinguishes us is that we care about freedom of speech and freedom of expression. We work as hard as possible to enshrine those values in countries around the world. But what we're talking about is then this free speech that has a pernicious effect across society.
And where does, you know, free speech cross the line into hate speech? That's the dilemma in the United States.
It certainly is. My conclusion, from having studied this as I have, is that governments, even as they understand the new dangers of this online speech, should be very cautious legislating anything regarding freedom of expression, because doing so opens the door to exploitation, if not by the ruling party, then by someone in the future. That's a very dangerous path. A better option, still not a good one, but one that we are increasingly seeing, is a standard of speech and expression set by Facebook and these other large social media companies that is a little bit stricter than the government standard, where they might moderate hate speech, which would be very difficult to define in a court, but whose pernicious effects are nonetheless undeniable. This is not an ideal solution, but it is the best one I've seen so far. And I want to draw a distinction between traditional speech, the speech in the town square, the speech between your neighbors, and online expression. Because in traditional speech and political organization, you only reached so many people at a time. And those people often would think more critically about what you were saying. And it'd be a longer period of time involved in the sort of organization. What we see with speech as it transits these social media platforms is that a piece of content can reach tens of millions of people in the course of just an hour. There's no context, there's no way to know whether the item in question is true, but it can drive people to action before they know all or any of the facts. That's a big distinction, and that's something, frankly, that our political organizations are not prepared for, because this has only been the reality in the last decade, and all of us are still trying to come to grips with it.
Now for a question from Mitch.
Yeah, another question, I guess, more in a on-the-ground sense. Can you talk more about how social media is used in actual on-the-ground wars? How does it spark violence and how does it mobilize? I think most notably you touched on the Syrian civil war, but can you think of other examples more recently?
Examples run the gamut. I'll touch briefly on two that highlight different aspects of this phenomenon. Our book opens with this, but in 2014, as the Islamic State invades northern Iraq, they sow hashtags. They have tens of thousands of followers around the world who are essentially spreading their content as quickly as possible. This actual ISIS invasion force is about 1,500 guys with AK-47s in dusty old pickup trucks. They're not that more impressive than any militant group before them. But that traditional power has a totally different dimension if you're sticking the right Instagram filter on their propaganda and ensuring that people see it. And indeed, when they were invading Iraq, in Arabic-speaking Twitter, they were the top trending hashtag for days. They could attach any of their propaganda, the barbarities they were inflicting on occupied towns, to that Twitter conversation. And all of a sudden, tens of thousands of people saw it and knew about it. In the case of Mosul, which was their principal target, a city of 1.5 million versus, again, 1,500 people, all it took was a few Iraqis with smartphones to be tracking this in real time for the fear to spread like a contagion. And in fact, it was worse that not so many people were connected because it allowed the rumors to spread wider and faster from the few people who did have online access. And as a consequence, the defenders of the city fled, then hundreds of thousands of other people fled. And this tiny invasion force achieved a tremendous victory thanks very much in part to their online propaganda.
Indeed, they spooked the Iraqi army, which were much more numerous.
Right. And a second more recent example is we're seeing this increasingly in tactical deployment on the battlefield. We have cases now where in occupied eastern Ukraine and on the front lines, Russian information operatives can find the phone numbers and sometimes the social media accounts of Ukrainian soldiers who are deploying. These Russian operatives can pretend to be the wives or siblings or family members of these Ukrainians. They can bombard them with fake messages that seem true. They can, in some cases, catfish them to download applications that reveal their GPS coordinates, which are then used by Russian artillery to target them. We are beginning to see ever more so a kind of merger of this online world and online dynamics and what happens on the physical battlefield.
Speaking of the Russians in Ukraine, you talk about in the book about the MH-17's destruction, and they were using all kinds of subterfuge to avoid responsibility, but somebody was tracking them and found that they were indeed responsible for the shooting down of the MH-17 flight from Netherlands to Malaysia. It was definitely the work of the Russians, but they were blaming the Ukrainians. Again, muddying the waters through social media, through their denials, and this is another pernicious use of social media and propaganda.
Certainly. The shootdown of MH17 in 2014 is a remarkable example, both as I alluded to earlier, of the censorship by means of disinformation. We know, thanks to open source intelligence, which was collected by a man working from home in England, that a Russian surface-to-air launcher shot down that airliner. Then separatist fighters attempted to hide it with camouflage netting, and then it exited the region some days later. Because of the availability of photographic and video evidence, and because of cheap satellite imagery that can be purchased by any casual hobbyist, we can track every stage of that journey, and in fact, identify the Russian soldiers responsible. And all of this information has been essential to a Dutch investigation of the crash. However, even as all this happened, the Russians sowed one storyline after another. It was a Ukrainian surface-to-air launcher. It was a CIA officer who given the order to shoot it down. It was a Ukrainian jet that shot it down. It had engine problems. All of these narratives, internally contradictory, but all just trying bit by bit to distract attention from that obvious truth.
That's exactly right. Distract attention with their pernicious use of propaganda. But it also depends on people's vulnerabilities or gullibility. And as we close, I want you to address that. You talked about concepts like gaslighting and homophily that are so important in fueling disinformation and that depend upon people who aren't using their perhaps critical faculties that are perhaps subject to prejudice or bias. So that leads us to ask, you know, what is the role of these concepts and the individual in combating the pernicious use of the internet in terms of promoting false narratives, lies? What can we do to educate the public, especially when they're seeing things online which don't have editors, which don't have authors? What must we do in order to combat this phenomenon that you so well describe?
For listeners and everyday folks, as we try to think about how to tackle this problem, I'd encourage you to think about the spread of misinformation like the spread of a virus. Think of the terms we use when we talk about a bit of information that's seen by a lot of people. We call it going viral. And as we see increasingly, this misinformation and disinformation that sometimes compels people to violence based on a false premise works the same way a virus does by attacking the weakest and most susceptible, the most credulous. But then, once it's believed by one person in a particular group, it's spread. And because of basic human nature, and this is the homophily word you mentioned, homophily means love of the same. We are more inclined to believe a claim when we see it shared by people who we already trust, who are already in our networks. And so when this first infected person spreads that bit of information, even if we would have initially laughed it off, we become increasingly inclined to believe it, or at least not to discount it. And quite often, we might share it in turn. Sharing something doesn't require all that much work or thought or analysis, because 60% of the links shared on Facebook are never clicked on by the people who shared them. You see something, you see your friends have shared it, you share it in kind, you pass it on, but as you do so, that viral infection grows ever larger. So as we think about this as a public health crisis, there are steps that these companies and governments can take. But for everyday folks, it's just important to think very critically when you see a claim before you share it, to investigate the source of that claim. And a great rule of thumb, something that I found very helpful, if you see a claim in one location, from one website or one actor online, is it being echoed by other people? How many people? And might they have some incentive or motive to make you believe that thing? You must ask these questions. And only then, with confidence, can you share it. And as we all work together to adopt these sorts of practices, we will never solve this problem, but we can learn more how to live in this new world that the internet and social media have created.
The book is Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media, the co-author, Emerson Brooking. Emerson, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your precious insights from this very important and timely book.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean. And joining me on the program was Mitch Biter, assistant producer in the Current Affairs Programming Unit. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.